Hello, everybody. I'm Tom Murray, the Director of Innovation for Future Ready Schools, a project of the Alliance for Excellent Education located in Washington, D.C. Future Ready Schools is a collaboration between the Alliance and a vast coalition of over 60 national and regional organizations. The goal of Future Ready Schools is to maximize digital learning opportunities and to help school districts move quickly towards personalized, student-centered learning. The effort provides districts with the resources and support to ensure that local technology and digital learning plans will also align with highly trained teachers, maximizing professional learning experiences for all students and teachers, and also particularly those from underserved communities. The hashtag for today's webinar is Future Ready. Thank you for making an investment and joining us today. I'm going to be your host on this webinar on hacking project-based learning. With me today is Ross Cooper, the Supervisor of Instructional Practice K-12 in the Salisbury School District, and Aaron Murphy, a Middle School Assistant Principal in the East Penn School District, both here in Pennsylvania. Ross and Aaron are also the authors of the best-selling book, Hacking Project-Based Learning. What an honor it is to have you with you both today, and thanks for joining us. Aaron, I'm going to go over to you first. Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I currently serve as an assistant principal at a middle school in the East Penn School District. My time in the classroom I spent in kindergarten, second, third, and fifth grade. I also have my certificate as a literacy coach and literacy and reading specialist. So I'm very involved in the ELA department here at our school.
Great. Ross, how about you?
So right now, as you said, I'm the curriculum supervisor in the Salisbury Township School District, which is in Allentown, Pennsylvania. This is my second year in the school district. Before that, I was an elementary assistant principal for a year. And before that, I had the honor, and Aaron had the honor of working with me in the same elementary school, of course, in the East Penn School District, where I was that was Willow Lane Elementary School. I was a fourth grade teacher for 6 years in East Penn. And before that, I taught third grade for half a year. So the majority, or actually pretty much all of my teaching experience is at the elementary level.
Awesome. Well, what a pleasure it is to have both of you here today. And, you know, I have to tell you, I've read through your book twice now, and the ideas and the way you talk about hacking, and I'll give a shout out to the whole hacking series. I know a lot of the authors through hacking, and it's a great, great series for our viewers to really go through some topics and to dive in. And I love the way it's really laid out there. So Ross, I'm going to ask you first. Let's start kind of a big picture idea here. We've got almost 500 viewers today. How do we define project-based learning? I think, you know, when we look at all the different buzzword bingo pieces that are out there in education, it's really important that we discuss from the get-go, what are we actually talking about? So let's really define from the get-go project-based learning. And I'm going to also ask you to contrast a little bit. How is project-based learning different than just the traditional projects that we all grew up doing?
All right. So to best answer that question, let's take a look at a graphic that actually was originally created by Aaron. So let's bring that up. And so what we have found, what Aaron and I have found, that in doing project-based learning professional development, rather than starting from the ground up and saying this is what PBL looks like, a lot of educators are already doing these traditional projects, which you see at the top, right? So if you take educators where they are, which is projects, and say, okay, you have this traditional project, how do you transform it into PBL? One, you're being respectful of where educators are by not asking them to throw out the baby with the bathwater, and two, it's something with which familiar because they're starting with something that they already have. So in a sense, as you can see, the difference between projects and project-based learning is projects is it's more the traditional learning that we've all done. And then that project happens at the end. It's almost like the cherry on top. It's like, congratulations, you've made your way through the unit. We've already graded you. We've already assessed you. And now as a result of that, because you got through this, you're going to do some type of project with the knowledge that you have already learned. Whereas with PBL, the big difference is students learn through the project. So the entire unit in and of itself, as you could see, is the project. And as you could see, all PBL unit, that conferencing or that conferring is absolutely huge. That's really the formative assessment process, which really is one of the aspects that really makes PBL so powerful, is because you're constantly taking a temperature read of where your students are and then adjusting your instruction accordingly. So that's really one of the main differences. But in a sense, it's really an inquiry-based unit. So you've heard of like backwards design, understanding by design. It's an inquiry-based unit in which the students uncover the understandings with which we want them to walk away, rather than just us covering them and trying to get through our pacing guide or trying to get through our curriculum. And as students uncover these understandings, through their project, they develop a deeper understanding of what they need to learn.
Great. And I think that ultimately we're all sort of shifting to this like student-centered approach to education. So as you mentioned, Tom, there are a ton of sort of buzzwords that people are throwing around, and we talk about project-based learning, but then we also talk about problem-based learning or place-based learning. And you know, we have all these different words that we throw around, and ultimately we're shifting from this student-centered, or I'm sorry, this teacher-centered philosophy of ed to a student-centered philosophy of ed. And we believe that PBL is one of the conduits you can use to get to this student-centered approach.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting that I like to share, I often refer to the Gallup Student Engagement Survey from 2015 that's well published. It's free online and people can check out. And when you take a look at the engagement rates of students, as reported, it's student feedback to us as educators nationwide. What's fascinating is it shows that essentially the longer that we have students in our school system, the less engaged they become, which to me tells us we've got to disrupt the historical trend of the teacher-centric environment, students sitting in desks in rows, teachers the delivery content model to get students that hands-on authentic experience that they need for their life ahead. And truly, it's a project-based world. I mean, not to be cliche-ish here, but it really, really is, and for their world moving forward. So Aaron, I'm gonna go back to you here. What keeps people then from jumping in? Like, what's that fear factor?
Sure, and I think that some of, like what you were sort of sharing there, Tom, is that, you know, people, first of all, I think many of us teach the way we were taught. So when we look, like you said, historically, we sort of had this model of education that was kind of okay, and everybody was getting by, and people were graduating, and we had jobs, and like, you know, it seemed to be working. But as we continue to research the brain and learning, we know that we're not doing as well as we could be doing. But then there's this question of like, well, how do I do it? And Ross and I have actually sort of coined this term, PBL paralysis, which is when people are sort of, you know, approach this idea of project-based learning and kind of freeze in their tracks. And there's lots of reasons this could happen. Sometimes it's people feel like the kids that they have in front of them would not be able to do PBL. And sometimes that's because they feel like they're too low or they're too high or they're too loud or any kind of label that you could throw at these kids. That's sometimes the reason that they feel like they can't get into PBL. Sometimes we hear that it's because of the test. You know, if I'm doing PBL, then I couldn't possibly be preparing kids to take our state standardized test. Sometimes it's grades. If I spend this much time working on project-based learning, then there's no way I'm going to have enough grades to put in my grade book. Or it could be, you know, I feel like as the professional, I have information I need to share with them. And they think that some people feel that direct instruction doesn't have a place in PBL. People just feel like they personally have not had the professional development that they need to implement PBL in their classrooms. So those are sort of the reasons I think that people hesitate to jump in, and then they, you know, are sort of faced with this PBL paralysis where they're kind of frozen and that seems really hard and scary. So instead, I'm just going to do what I've always done. And there's some ways that we can kind of battle that PBL paralysis, and we're actually going to talk about them, I'm sure, a little bit more throughout. But I think that kind of answers your question of like, that's what I think keeps people from jumping in.
Yeah, you know, I had the opportunity to hear both of you at a recent keynote that you did at a conference, and I love the way that you really dispelled a lot of the myths that you just shared by sharing the myth and then diving into what actually can happen. And, you know, being a longtime educator myself, I understand that fear factor comes typically from educators want to do a good job. Teachers want to do a good job in the classroom, and they're comfortable with what they're comfortable with. And so sometimes stepping out of that comfort zone, it causes that anxiety of, I still want to do a really good job. Am I going to be able to do it if I do it differently? And so I appreciate the way you all, through your work and through also being able to hear you speak, really try to dispel a lot of that and meet educators where they are. Thought it was great. Ross, anything you want to jump in that? Any other kind of fear factors or pieces that you've seen in terms of that fear getting into PBL? Anything you wanted to add to that with her?
Yeah, I think a lot of times, just like with any other initiative, if we're somebody who's trying to facilitate this and trying to get teachers to move forward, teachers generally, you could use all the books in the world, and books are great, and all the resources in the world, but a lot of times videos help as well. And that's what I have found through facilitating a lot of professional development. People really want to see what it looks like in action. And if it's not a videos, it's maybe through like site visits or getting teachers getting into each other's classrooms. And that really has helped in my profession in regards to teachers like overcoming those hurdles and seeing, wrapping their heads around, okay, what does this exactly look like? And then getting this idea of, okay, now how, giving the teachers time to plan, okay, I've seen it, now how can I transfer it into my classroom? That's something that I've seen that works. And also, you know, even in our book, like we provide this framework. Yes, there's these different aspects. We always say, okay, maybe there's 8 or 9 or 10 different aspects to PBL, but it's great, but sometimes they're a little bit disjointed and disconnected. But I think sometimes we need this kind of framework that takes us from beginning to end as much as possible. And that's something that we really try to provide. And the path is never smooth, right? The path is never smooth. There's always these unforeseen hurdles that we have to deal with. But as much as possible, you know, we try to provide this framework to get teachers, you know, to feel comfortable with what they're doing, to get them to dive in, and then you reflect, you iterate, and then you go from there.
Yeah, it's certainly well said. And, you know, one of the things that I took away from your book is you hit on this notion, and Ross, what you were just saying is the whole, like, what does this actually look like? And I think that is such a valid question. I think we really need to ask those kind of questions. I think we often start so many times in education with the what instead of the why, and how do we move from the why to the practical, what does it look like in implementation? And I think sometimes we, as admin and all admin ourselves, can sometimes easily tell teachers, you know, we can't do it the traditional way anymore. We can't do it the way we've always done it. They don't really do a good job of showing them what it should look like. And so kind of puts them in an interesting spot. And so I couldn't agree with you more there. I think that's great. One of the pieces as we start to dive into what it does look like that I really like that you hit in your book there was this notion of this big idea and how a big idea can really drive these different pieces. So how do you decide what to focus on in a PBL experience? What happens if you don't have some sort of a big idea?
So I think, and this is definitely a mistake that I'm made as a teacher, is that there's a big difference between engagement for us as a teacher and relevance for students. So the whole idea of engagement versus relevance is huge, not just in PBL, but in education in general. So one of the examples that I give is, you know, I'm a big food buff. You know, I absolutely love food. So of course, as a fourth grade teacher, I had my students write restaurant reviews. You know, I want them to be excited about restaurant reviews. But did I ever ask my students if they liked food, if they were big food buffs? You know, I wanted them to get excited about my interests rather than me asking them what their interests are. And me asking them what their interests are, that's relevance as opposed to me trying to engage them where I'm at. So I think a lot of times the whole idea of giving our students a voice and asking them what they want to tackle is absolutely huge, because as much as we have the standards, and I think sometimes we use the standards almost as an excuse to not move forward, we have these standards, but there's countless ways we can meet those standards and countless ways our students can meet those standards. And that really is where the art of teaching comes in. So if we have the standards and we know what's relevant to our students by giving them a voice, there are definitely ways to meld the two. And I think that's a great starting point.
Erin, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think that, you know, when I was in the classroom, I spent a lot of time trying to dream up like this big idea. And then I think that when the big idea didn't come, that became another freezing point. Mm-hmm. So I think that a good focus is making sure that you don't feel like it has to be huge. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's going to be something that's just really little. I talked to a teacher today who was a kindergarten teacher, and she was like, you know, people I'm working with are building gardens and designing, you know, buildings with retractable roofs. And I'm with my kindergartners, and I kind of feel like, you know, what are my kindergartners going to do? And she came up with this idea where her kids basically were folding paper and experimenting with different angles until they created something that could fly. So it was simple. Like, it was, you know, her kids were using paper, and they were her 5-year-olds, and it's something that really worked for them. So I think that that's important too, is to think about, you know, finding something that works for you and not worrying about, you know, whether it's something the news media is going to want to come cover.
I think sometimes we have this idea, and this is definitely an obstacle, that we had that, you know, PBL has to be this big authentic thing. We're going to solve these real world problems, right? And that really, I think, is a barrier to teachers implementing PBL, because it can be intimidating. And what you're talking about, Erin, is basically inquiry. You know, it doesn't have to be maybe this mini unit that's done within, you know, the span of maybe a week or so, but it's really just inquiry and students uncovering these understandings. And I think that's really what it's all about. It doesn't have to be this grand idea where, you know, where students are going to save the world. Yes, that would be great. And yes, it would be great if they could solve real world problems. But if we do that 24/7 in our classrooms, you know, we're going to be burnt out and our students are going to be burnt out. So really at the heart of it is that inquiry that Erin is talking about.
Great. I do want to remind our viewers that the hashtag for today's webinar is Future Ready, as always. Feel free to ask your questions. We've seen come in recently on Twitter, and we'll be monitoring that as well. Aaron, I want to jump back over to you. Let's talk. You mentioned earlier about direct instruction and where that might fit into project-based learning. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I think, again, that's one of those freezing points. That's where teachers feel like, you know, I have a lot to say, I have a lot to share, and, you know, I don't think that kids are going to come and naturally want to learn about a Punnett square or naturally learn how genetics work. So, you know, how does that work? And I think that it's important to sort of put out there that in a PBL classroom, that does not necessarily mean that direct instruction does not exist. It does exist. It just, we sort of shift when and where that direct instruction takes place. So first of all, when you're talking about direct instruction during PBL, you want to make sure that it's happening sort of just in time. One of the reasons the gaming industry is so successful is because they offer students information, or they offer the gamer information that they need just when they need it. Think about sitting down to play a game and having to read through, like, you know, a chapter's worth of directions and new information, and then you get to play your game and then you get to do the project. Instead, we sort of want to break up that information. You start playing first, experiment a little bit with the new concept, with the topic, and then you get information as you go. And I really think that that is what sort of drives students along. And when we talk about direct instruction during a PBL unit, we call it a mini lesson on purpose, because it's sort of a very small chunk of time. Give students some new information, let them play and experiment again. Then they get a little bit more information, some new information, and then they play and experiment again. So that's sort of how the direct instruction works, so that it's sort of fit into where the students need it in order for them to continue to move forward in their process.
And I think that Aaron hit on a huge point. When that direct instruction takes place is really critical. So for instance, if I'm in a science teacher's classroom and he's giving, and they're going to do an experiment, but they need to learn information as a result of that experiment, and I do that direct instruction first, and I say, as a result of this experiment, you're going to learn X, Y, and Z, then, you know, what's the point of the experiment if you're only going to find out what you already know? Like, you're going to find out information that you already know what it's going to be. You know what the end result is going to be. Whereas if you put that, all you're doing is really changing the order and putting that experiment first and then getting together afterwards and saying, okay, what did we learn? And then filtering in that direct instruction. And maybe sometimes as a result of that experiment, students will uncover that information, or maybe they won't because the experiment went wrong. But either way, it's a teachable moment. So really, a lot of times, it's just a matter of taking that direct instruction and moving it as far back as possible and using it kind of almost like, you know, a support at the end to say, okay, as a result of what you did, let's just hammer home those key points rather than hammering it home first and sucking the inquiry out of the learning process.
During an end of year meeting I had with one of my teachers this year, the teacher said, you know, I have these activities and experiences that, you know, my students really love, and with the new curriculum redesign, I feel like these activities and experiences that have been successful, we're not going to have this opportunity to do them again, because now we need, like, now it's going to be more inquiry based. And what we sort of came to, and what I helped them understand during that meeting, was that you don't need to throw away your it's just, let's do the activity first and then filter in your direct instruction afterwards. And that was sort of, you know, that plays to the point that Ross brought up earlier. We don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Your experiment's probably great. Let's just do it at a different time. So that's the shift.
The same exact lesson or activity done in two different classrooms could look entirely different. Like if you're doing like an egg drop, you know, like that's a traditional science project, or the pinball machines that I did in my classroom. Two teachers in rooms right next to each other, same exact project, could look entirely different depending on their approach of the teacher.
Yeah, and what's interesting is we've standardized so much in education across the board, nationally, locally, and those kinds of things, to start to hear that, you know, my teaching partner and I could have very different experiences on the same idea. That can be a bit scary for teachers, in that, you know, that almost that fear of the unknown, which on one hand we can certainly understand. You know, again, people want to do a really good job by default. But Jonathan New York just asked a good question. It really goes back to some of what we were saying earlier, and maybe this will help. But what are some resources or sources out there that teachers can go to really see examples of project-based learning, or to see some other resources for it? What are some go-to resources that they can really see it in action, those types of things? Where would you point them?
So one of the go-to sort of resources, or sort of like a one-stop shop almost, is the Buck Institute. So the Buck Institute website offers a ton of resources, some project examples, rubrics and things to get you started if you're looking for ways to assess student learning. That's definitely a good resource. Edutopia has a project-based learning page, and that's also an excellent resource. Ross and I also really like the Getting Smart blog. They write a lot about project-based learning. They also have a project-based learning topic page. Ross, am I missing some of our other favorites?
No, I think those are the big three. But I think it's also important to realize that the people that are creating these projects have never met you and they've never met your students. So it's great to have this cool idea, but it doesn't end there. And we want to think critically about these cool ideas to make sure it's meeting our standards, make sure it's meeting the needs of our students, making sure that it's inquiry-based, and that we're developing our own capacity to do PBL, because if we're just copying and pasting something that we found on the internet and putting it in the hands of our students, then we might as well be using, you know, a paint by numbers program or a textbook, you know. So I think we just have to make sure that in the process of doing this, we're meeting the needs of our students and building our own capacity.
Yeah, such a great point there, Ross, on that. You know, so much of the work that we do with Future Ready and working with thousands of leaders across the country, even asking about their own learning experiences or their own professional learning experiences, and boiling it down to what works, and backing up by research, it's what's personal, what's authentic, what's that learning that takes place there. And so I think that's such a great point there, that we always have to tailor it to the kids sitting in front of us. And I think the greatest teachers always do that, and they understand mm-hmm. their kids every year are not standard. There's kids every year are unique and individuals, and we certainly need to plan and work through that to them. One of the questions that comes up that I love the way you addressed it throughout the book, but I really want to hear from you and have our audience hear from you as well, is the notion of assessment. You know, we think about traditional assessments. We think about, you know, even common assessments across the board or standardized testing. And I'm going to ask you a follow-up question related to that came in as well, and this notion of standardized testing and how do we handle something like that in a project-based learning environment. But anyway, this notion of assessment, you know, if I'm a teacher and I'm used to, well, here's kind of my summative assessment at the end, or my unit test, or whatever the case may be, maybe this is what comes with the curricular materials. And again, I'm overgeneralizing there, but from general assessments, what does assessment look like in project-based learning?
So I think one of the things that we have to make sure that we're clear on, but you know, just in general, when we're working with teachers or administrators, is the difference between assessment and grading, right? It's possible to continually formatively assess a PBL experience or any type of learning experience, but not necessarily throw a grade at it. And what Aaron and I believe is that because project-based learning in particular is so dripping with inquiry and creativity, what the research tells us is that if we throw a grade at PBL or at creativity, we're going to squash creativity. That's essentially what's going to happen. So what we want to do is really put the emphasis on the formative assessment process by constantly checking in with our students, maybe through those mini lessons, through conferring, through conferencing, whatever, what have you, and then adjusting our instruction accordingly. That being said, a more formal tool that Aaron and I created to do that is the progress assessment tool, and that's highlighted in our book. A lot of times when we hear projects, we say, okay, we need a rubric to go with it, and the rubric could be downright scary. And to be honest, I don't even think I ever did them really that well when I was in the classroom. So Aaron and I said, okay, how can we build the rubric from the ground up so it's not intimidating? And so what we created was a progress assessment tool, and the key word there is progress. We put the emphasis on the progress with feedback, continuous feedback throughout the project to move students forward. And basically, it's a three-column tool. In the left-hand column, you have your learning targets. In the middle column, you say, how do these learning targets apply? What do they look like within the context of the project? And then the right-hand column, it's feedback, or more specific feedback in regards to each one of those learning targets. And that feedback can be left by the teacher, not at the end of the project, but throughout the project so students can adjust. It can be left by peers, or ideally, a student should be giving it to his or herself so they have that witness to guide their own learning process. So really what we don't want to do is we don't want to necessarily grade the project itself. We want to provide feedback throughout the project and assess it. That being said, if we do have to have a certain type of grade, we would recommend some type of some type of assessment that kind of stands outside of the project itself. And maybe that's your more traditional, open-ended assessment. Maybe it's a video that students create. Maybe it's some type of mini website that they create. But we don't generally recommend grading the project itself because you're going to squash creativity. If we want to see growth, the research tells us that grades are not the answer.
And I think the other powerful piece of the progress assessment tool is that it's built around your learning objectives. And again, this process is more clearly articulated in the book. But essentially, you start with your standards, your state standards, the things that kids are going to be tested on. We write them in student-friendly language. We put them on the progress assessment tool, and then throughout the project, you're conferencing with kids to make sure that they are making growth on those standards, on those objectives. So that's sort of the way that, whether you need to prove to yourself or prove to your administrator that I am making sure that students know and understand things that eventually they are going to be, that are going to be on the state assessment. If that is something that you need to do, this tool helps you do it. It also helps gain buy-in from parents. Like when you maybe aren't posting as many grades and parents want to know, well, what's my kid doing? You say, come on in, take a look. Take a look at this progress assessment tool. Here today, this is a conversation I had with your kid related to this learning objective. And, this is what they showed me. And you would have those notes, sort of like your anecdotal notes on that progress mm-hmm. assessment tool. It's the evidence for you, for your students, for your parents, for your administrators, for other teachers that, your students are learning, and this is what they're learning, and this is how they're learning it.
Yeah. So, Kathleen, I want to keep going down this assessment path here. Kathleen from South Carolina asked a little bit earlier. One, it's a question that Aaron, you alluded to a little bit earlier when you were talking kind of about some of the PBL paralysis and the myths that may be out there. And she asked the question that I'm sure many people have asked you previously. And it's that notion of the standardized test. Here's my state mm-hmm. test at the end of the year. I teach in a course or something that's a grade level that's tested. And that natural fear of, if I spend all this time doing all these things, I see the value in it. But what about that test? How do you handle that? What do you respond to that? Why? And I'm sure as two administrators in school districts currently, you probably get that question. So what do you say to that?
Well, some of it is what we just sort of explained. This idea that as long as you have very clear learning objectives for your project, you are going to be teaching your kids what they need to learn. And it feels like it's taking more time. But in reality, that's not necessarily the case. When I think about, if each lesson in your book or in your curriculum takes 2 days, and then, you spend a day sort of like kicking off the unit, and then you spend a day reviewing, and then you spend a day testing, and then you spend a day going over the test, and then you spend countless minutes each period going over homework. That's all time that you can use to be doing project-based learning. So yes, it's going to look different. Yes, it's going to feel different. But it's something you kind of just have to test out. And then you're going to prove to yourself that you're getting, I had a teacher, a math teacher this year who was experimenting with project-based learning. And the mindset or the idea was that, in the end, she was able to go faster. At first, it feels a little bit slower because you're kind of building the momentum, building the culture in your classroom to support project-based learning. But then eventually, once you have those pieces in place, you're moving faster because you're not spending all this extra time reteaching things to the whole class when you really only need to be reteaching them to a small group of students. And now you've created this structure in your classroom to make that happen.
So Aaron, you bring up a great point that it's actually easier. It's a step backwards at first, just like anything else. But if you're going home every night or going to school every day saying, what am I going to teach for this? What am I going to teach for that? You're essentially doing it wrong. Unit plans or inquiry-based unit plans or PBL plans, it's a much easier process once you're able to grasp it. So there's more planning up front, but then it's really just about meeting the individual needs of your students. In regards to hitting the standards, a lot of them tie into literacy, right? A lot of those standardized tests are literacy-based. You could tie literacy into pretty much any project that you're doing, whether it's nonfiction reading comprehension, whether it's writing, whether it's spelling, whether it's grammar, any type of project that you do. You can infuse it with a whole bunch of literacy to make sure that students are being prepared for the test.
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing is that still focusing very hard on those learning targets from the get-go. It's not a free-for-all project. It's a very focused and very planned and purposeful in that regard. So I'm guessing with the number of viewers that we have today, people are probably all over the map with this type of learning and these types of learning experiences or project-based learning itself. And so what type of advice do you have? You probably have those people that are, hey, we're looking to just put our toe in the water and just maybe get started. And you probably have those people that could have also been on the webinar today that have been doing PBL, that it's a passion area for them. What advice do you have for people, regardless of where they are on the continuum, so to say? So Erin, let's start with you first. What advice do you have for people watching today?
Sure. So I think the first thing is don't be afraid. So you really need to find, you need to find the entry point that works for you. And Ross and I sort of approach project-based learning looking at three different tracks. The first track being the set project track. And sometimes there's this mindset or fear that, you know, if every kid in my class is doing the same project, then it is not project-based learning. And throughout our book, we talk about a project that Ross did with his students, this Pinball Wizard project, where every student designed a pinball machine. So every kid in his class designed a pinball machine, but the difference was that each kid took a different path to get there. There was, their journey was different. So again, same project, but allowing the flexibility in your classroom for that journey to look different. The next path is the problem path, and that's where students sort of approach a problem and try to solve the problem. And that one can kind of have like two different lanes, in that sometimes everyone in the class is trying to solve the same problem, or sometimes you pose a, you know, you kind of identify a topic and then students find their own problem related to that topic. So one example might be that in my class, when I was in my classroom, I had students try to solve this trash problem in our school. We talked about the fact that there seemed to be trash that was just piling up out of the trash cans. And when we looked at, we were like, oh gosh, things in that trash can could really be getting recycled, but we don't have a recycling program. So as a class, we sort of worked to solve that particular problem while we were learning about ecology in our class. Another way you could approach that is by saying, okay, students, we're going to study ecology. Here's a little bit of background information about ecology. And then students create their own questions related to that that then they explore and work on throughout the unit. And the last is sort of the open-ended path, and this is where like Genius Hour or 20% time come into play, where students are just exploring something that is of interest to them, and then they're being supported in doing that throughout the class. But the bottom line is that we need to make sure that everybody is finding their own entry point. So, you know, Tom, you use that term toe in the water, and that is how we like to think about it. So if, you know, the swimming pool is our student-centered schools, learner-centered experiences, that's our pool. You know, some people feel way more comfortable just going in one toe at a time. Some people can jump in the deep end and they're ready to go. And, you know, some people are still like on the lounge chair putting their suntan lotion on, and that's okay too. But we all want to be like making our steps towards that pool, getting into that pool. So find the thing that works for you. And that might mean that you're not going to do all PBL at one time. It might just mean that you are going to try like redesigning your classroom so that it meets your learners' needs. It may mean that you're going to just try flipping when that experiment happens in your classroom. Maybe it's first instead of coming last. So find the thing that kind of works for you. And if you need to start with an idea or a project from the Buck Institute or one of those resources, do that. Start there. Let that be your first experience. But then build from that, reflect on it, think about how I could have connected my kids to this more. But again, don't be afraid to just try something. No one's going to be waiting to tell you you did it wrong.
Yeah. Russ, what about you? What advice do you have for the viewers?
So I think first, Erin touched upon a great point. This whole idea that the big secret is that a lot of teachers are already doing project-based learning or parts of project-based learning, and they just don't know it. So whether it's like, you know, giving effective feedback, redesigning your classroom, using some type of rubric, having the student solve problems, that might not be a full-blown PBL unit, but teachers are definitely on their way there. And in working with teachers, I think we found that they're pretty surprised when it's saying, wait a minute, like I'm already doing PBL, you know, or I'm already doing parts of PBL. So I think, you know, if we're educators, we're intimidated by it. We, as Erin said, there's all these multiple entry points that we could choose based on our needs and based on what's comfortable for us and our students. Just like we want to differentiate learning for our students, it's differentiated professional development for us in regards to where we begin. So all of this, you know, it's not black and white. It's not either you're doing PBL or you're not doing PBL. I guarantee you the majority of teachers are already doing parts of PBL in their classrooms. It's just a matter of continuing to move in that direction. One of the things that worked for Aaron and I too was when we started out with PBL in our particular district, in the East Penn School District, as part of the initiative, it was, we don't want to overwhelm you, but this year the goal is we're going to support you, but the goal is that we just want you to take one unit this year with which you're comfortable and redesign it to make it a PBL experience. So that's something else to keep in mind, this whole idea, as Aaron alluded to, you don't have to redesign everything, but just choose one unit that really lends itself to PBL. And if you're an elementary school teacher, probably something that's like science, you know, science really, really helps. But any subject, you know, whether it's language arts, math, science, or social studies could be PBL. And just start with that one unit, you know, collaborate with your colleagues, collaborate with colleagues, you know, in and out of your district, and then just iterate and go from there and reflect once you're done.
And I believe you guys have a hashtag you constantly use to share things on different ideas with PBL. What is that hashtag? Hacking PBL, correct?
Hacking PBL.
I'm sure that you find some great resources there. It is always awesome to be able to talk to authors who have poured their hearts into to work like this and done the studies and taken a look and also addressed some of the myths. And I can't thank you enough. Certainly recommend the book, Hacking Project-Based Learning. It is absolutely dynamic. Love the way you've all written that. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today and being able to share that around the nation today as well. I do want to remind our viewers that information on the Future Ready effort can be found at futureready.org. We encourage and challenge district superintendents to join over 3,100 district superintendents that have signed the Future Ready District Pledge. We also encourage our school leaders watching today to join us at one of this year's 8 Future Ready Institutes, which, as always, are totally free for leaders. This year, we have a district leadership strand, a principal strand, an IT strand, a librarian strand, and an instructional coaches strand. We have Albany, Future Ready Albany in New York coming up in July, and Future Ready Palm Springs in California coming up in August. I also want to encourage our viewers to get involved, as we mentioned, with one of these strands. We can check out those new strands also on Facebook now. Any of those strands, we encourage you to check those out as well. I do want to thank both Ross and Aaron, as well as you, our viewers, for investing the time today. Don't forget to connect with us here at Future Ready on Twitter, at Future Ready, and on Facebook at facebook.com/FutureReadySchools. If you missed any of today's conversation, it's going to be archived at all4ed.org/webinar soon after this webinar. On that page, you can also see the list of upcoming webinars. Specifically, I hope you can join us for our next Future Ready webinar, which is going to be on communications planning for innovation and education, a new guide and district profiles on June 29th at 2 p.m. You can also find all of the Alliance's Google Hangouts on air on that channel as well. For those of you taking part in our Action Academy badging platform, the password for today's webinar is HACK. Thank you again for joining us here at Future Ready. Have a fabulous day. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.